Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhouseonline.com.au.
Gemma Sissia was a country kid riding horses, racing camels, mustering sheep when she first saw footage from the Ethiopian famine of the 1980s. And those images sparked a passion in her for Africa, which years later led to her building a school in the East African nation of Tanzania. The School of St. Jude, it's called. It opened its doors in 2002 with 3 students. Today it's changing the lives of more than 1,000 students who are amongst Tanzania's poorest. Gemma's back home for a quick trip and she's here now. Hello, Gemma.
Hi.
Is here home now?
No, Tanzania is. The School St. Jude goes through a yearly cycle of fundraising and then construction of new buildings and then enrollment of new kids and employment of new staff. So I'm out here on
this
fundraising.
This is a fundraising trip.
Yeah.
So you never really would have thought that this is the way your life would have turned out.
Never. And I often think, like, when I was little, driving on the bicycle down to the and going over the ramp and waiting for the school bus, if a genie had come and said that this is what you're going to be doing in another 10 years, I would have told them to get back in the bottle.
Yes.
Or go back to the pub.
So, I mean, yeah, that was more likely. So, I mean, you saw the footage from Ethiopia, like we all did back in those days, and it really, you know, it really shocked you, obviously. Then you were a volunteer at the age of 23 and you head over to Tanzania for the first time.
Yeah, so, you know, it was when that first Ethiopian Sudan, you know, the famine footage, and it was before the 40-hour famine and that big, you know, the big concert.
We Are the World.
Yeah. Mm. Anyway, so, you know, I was young and I remember thinking that, you know, I'd love to go across and start handing food out of the back of the truck as if that's how it happened. So I always wanted to go over to Africa, but Mum and Dad said I had to get a degree first or some sort of tertiary qualification. So as soon as I finished uni, I jumped on a plane and headed across there as a volunteer teacher. But, you know, coming from a family that educated, you know, that education was important, I think my mother bought herself a dress once a decade. School fees in our family was always a priority. And going over there and seeing kids without desks and chairs and, you know, pencil being a rarity, just, you know, such poor, poor education. And I was young and naive, and I remember thinking, you know, surely it shouldn't be that hard to build a good, decent private school that's free of charge. I mean, why hasn't somebody done that by now? I mean, surely it's not that hard. Well, it's been really hard. But luckily then I didn't know much about what I was heading towards. So I excitedly...
Ignorance can really be bliss when it comes to wonderful things, can't
it? Yes, you know, because...
you don't know you can't do it.
Yeah, but, you know, now I question things a lot. And I remember when I went across to build that school, I had $200 in my pocket. I'd closed all my bank accounts here and I was heading across. There's no way I would travel with $200 in my pocket now. I'd make sure, you know, it's, you know, that blissful, you know, infallibility type attitude. Anyway, so I got back here after volunteering over there and I was talking to a great friend, Agnes Henner. And we were in Armidale and we were having afternoon tea and I was telling her how I wanted to build this school. And so she was a great mate and she said, well, why, you know, here's your first donation, Gem. She gave me $10. And actually, I saw Agnes last year in Melbourne. She came to an event and I was so excited to see her. And I said, Agnes, can you give me another $10? That first one went pretty well. Anyway, so then I went to our local Rotary Club and a few of our local schools and we started raising money. And we'd raised about $15,000 after a few months. And then we organised a group of volunteers from my hometown of Armidale to go across with the money that we'd raised to start building the classroom. So about 2002 was the year then that the classrooms were ready for opening. Now, the aim for this school was for our kids to have a free, quality private education. And I would find people here to sponsor each of them. And but the problem was back then, not many people knew about the school except for Mum and Dad and a few friends. So we could only find 3 sponsors to begin with. And that's why we could only start the school with 3 kids.
Is that it? Because you only had 3 sponsors.
Yeah.
Now, actually, going a few steps back, didn't you actually try a different model, but you were actually struggling with how the dollars were actually being used over in Africa when you weren't there?
Yes. So initially, you know, I was raising money for kids in existing schools. And I had a lot of money lost. Basically, I lost a lot of money. I'd send it to headmasters and headmasters would use the money for their personal benefit. And so my children weren't going to school. So there was a number of reasons, and in the end, it's just like, oh, you know, I'm just let's just build our own school.
There you go.
Thinking that it'd be really easy.
Yes, really easy. Jim Asisia, who's the founder of the School of St. Jude in Tanzania, is with us. So you start with these three students. That's all the sponsors you actually had for them, and you start holding class.
Yes, and that first day of school, I remember being in bed by 5:30 in the afternoon, and I remember thinking, sure, you know, we only got three students. How come it's so hard to run a school? And I still go to bed quite early, but at least we've got a few more kids now that we're educating.
What was the turning point from 3 to then 30 to then 300 to then?
Well, it just depended on, you know, in the first few years, I basically what we do each year is come out to Australia raising money. Now, in the first few years, I'd email everyone that I knew and I'd say, I'm coming out. And if you're willing to raise an event or help, you know, if you're willing to have me as a speaker in your conference or your Rotary Club, contact me. And in the first year, after a week, I'd used up all my
available appointments.
Yeah. Hmm. And then the next year, we'd have to be out here for a couple of weeks. And then the year, and so depending on how much money we could raise on our fundraising trip, it determined how many buildings we could build, which in turn determined how many new kids got into the school.
Mm-hmm.
And in turn, which, you know, determined how many new staff, local staff we could employ. Now we've capped it just for quality reasons, capped it at 200 new students a year. Just, I mean, you could imagine if a private school here in Australia was free of charge, you can imagine the amount of, well, you know, the amount of children wanting to get into it, first of all, but the amount of headaches of trying to increase enrollment by 200 kids each year. There's a lot of building that goes around. You know, for every 25 new children that we enroll in the school, it means we've got to build another 25 desks and chairs, another 10 bunk beds, get another classroom up, more tables and benches for the dining hall, more plates, spoons, another teacher, another cook, driver, bus, quarter of acre of land for them to play on. So there's a lot of infrastructure that goes in and around expansion each year.
Yeah. Mm. All right. So what are you up to now? Obviously, 1,000 students.
A bit over 1,300.
Okay, it's gone up since we last saw. Right. Obviously, it's last year's figures we're looking at here.
So I don't like to give more than 600 children to a headmaster. So there's two campuses that are. We've got two separate primary schools that each have their own headmaster and leadership team. It's like having two Christian Brothers schools or two Catholic schools. I mean, they're of the same family, but of different leadership. And then each of those at full capacity. And where we're growing at the moment is secondary. So we have a secondary school with its own headmaster. And we did that because when I started the school in 2002, our kids were in grade one. Then in 2003, they moved into grade two. Those children this year are in year eight in secondary. Each year we increase a year according to our oldest kids. So next year we'll go to year nine for the first time, the year after year 10. So it's 2014 is the year when we get our first year 12 graduates.
Mm-hmm.
So we have to keep building.
That's when the university starts, is that right? You'll be raising funds for a university.
That's why we just got to keep building to around 2014. And that's when the three schools will be at full capacity.
Mm. Let's talk about a couple of things. One is the intake. Now, I remember, I think it was Australian Story or something that was talking about how, yes, you take the poorest of the poor in Tanzania, but you actually have some fairly stringent requirements for the kids too. They've got to show some degree of aptitude.
Yeah, so it's growing out of. I've basically seen Jude's. I'd never built a school in my life. I mean, I did genetics at
Most
uni.
Most of us haven't.
Yeah. You know, did genetics at uni as if that's going to help me build schools, you know, and I came from a farming family. Yeah. I mean, if you've ever met a rich farmer, so it's not like I had a lot of money behind me. So the likelihood of this school getting off the ground was a pretty hopeless case. And that's why I called the School of St. Jude, because St. Jude is known as the patron saint of the hopeless.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so it was, it's basically grown out of problems, solving problems. So that's how we've got up with the school. So the selection policy has also evolved every year based on problems that we had the year before. So when I started the school, I just wanted to help poor children. I just wanted to make sure that there was a quality private school that was accessible to the poor. But sadly, some of the kids that I enrolled in the first year of operations back in 2002 didn't last very long because they never turned up to school. They never did their homework. There was no effort. There was no care. So then I thought, okay, we've got to change our policy and say, okay, I want to help poor children still, but they have to want to have a good education. And then also over the last 8 years, I've sort of discovered what type of Tanzanian employers, such as myself, are looking for.
Mm.
So we have about 350 Tanzanians on our staff. And I can find teachers by the million, but I've had to breed our own headmasters. I can find brickies, electricians, plumbers by the million, but I've never had an electrical engineer on our building programs. We have to get one from the capital city, which is about 800 kilometres away, but that's not very effective. Trying to find a gynaecologist over there to have my three children has been a bit of fun. It's a serious no-frills package there if you want to have children. So there's a whole level of very high-skilled professionals that is lacking. And because of that, the growth of the infrastructure of the country suffers and the quality of that infrastructure suffers. But I want our kids to compete for a job with you. That's my aim. So for that, so we are simply trying to make our kids as employable as possible. So we are very selective. We want kids who are proactive, self-taught, have a lot of initiative, don't need hand-holding because there is no hand-holding there. So that's why our selection policy over the years has changed tremendously.
And so the obvious next question is, what does happen to those kids who don't make the grade?
So, you know, we might get 1,000 children a week coming to the testing days, maybe 7.
1,000 a week?
Yep, maybe a 7 will get in. The next week, maybe 10. That means we're now up to 17. The following week, we might get 20. That means we're now up to 37. The next week, we might only get 5, and we keep doing it every week from around August to December, every week until we get our quota of 200. What happens to the other children? Well, they go into the government system where our kids would have gone to. So the government system is very poor, but we just simply cannot help everybody. So my name is Gemma, and my contribution to education in Africa is I can maximise at this stage help 200 kids a year. So
you've just got to know your limits, haven't you? I mean, you just can't do it. 1,000 kids a week,
yes,
turning up.
But it is a private school and it is free of charge.
Yes.
So
you're attractive. Yeah.
So you can imagine if a private school here said, okay, we now have free school fees.
Yeah.
Everybody
would be
lining
up. Yeah, well, you'd have 1,000 kids a week there. That's for sure. and like you said, though, your real aim is to raise up leaders, because these will be the people that hopefully will be able to provide more employment for the rest of the country.
And they're we've got some incredible kids. One of our primary school kids last year, off his own back, got a textbook out of the library and made himself an electric bell out of a phone charger and a Band-Aid and some nails and some cardboard and a little bill, and it really worked. And I said to him, if you make some big ones, I'll buy them off you and I'll install them around the school. Yeah, lots of stories.
I bet. This is Open House. We're hearing the story of Gemma Sissia, who is the founder and director, I guess, would you call yourself, of the School of St. Jude in Tanzania? What's your official business card title?
Yes, it's director.
Director, yeah.
But I spend most of my time in construction.
Yeah.
And trying to raise money.
Yes.
So my job is, at the end of this year, we have to have desks and chairs and classrooms and a playground ready for 200 extra kids. And if there's not, I get in a lot of trouble.
All right. Okay. You get your backside smacked.
<That's>
you
right.
go into detention.
Uh-huh.
Give us a rundown of your average day. What time you get up and what time you go to bed and what happens in between?
Well, I have three children of my own. So I've got an 8-year-old, 6-year-old and a 2-year-old. So our house wakes up at 5:45 every morning. And we have a rule with the kids that no one is allowed to wake up before the dark is finished. Although there's some debate about when the dark is finished. My youngest comes in and goes, oh, but it's blue black. It's not really black. So we start quite early. And then my youngest children, they go to school at 7:00 in the morning. Everyone's left the house by 7:00. And that's when I go to the office as well. And so I find I get a huge amount of work done before school starts, which is 8:30. And then from 8:30, it's meeting after meeting after meeting, just solving problems, setting more processes into place, answering questions to various section leaders. So we have head of guards, head of cooks, purchasing, building, headmaster questions, academic questions, dealing with a lot of our sponsors and donors and people who are asking information. And then I come home. I find home a refuge. So I don't go out very much. I just love being home. So I go home and I just really, really enjoy being with my family. So I'm a bit of a hermit, really.
Yeah. Well, with all that kind of flurry of activity around you, I can understand that very well. Now, you originally were thinking of being a nun, weren't
you? Yes.
Yeah.
So when I was growing up, I always wanted to work in Africa, as I was saying. And, you know, I was thinking about entering the convent, and that's why I did a university degree first, and then I did a diploma in education. So I was either thinking about becoming a sister or marrying a farmer and having 5 kids and having to have an off-farm income. So that's why I thought teaching would be a good extra. So that's what I did it for. And I actually lived with sisters for the few years that I worked as a volunteer teacher and loved it. But I'm really quite pig-headed, and it was a pretty mutual agreement, right? Probably within a couple of months, so it wasn't the right track for me.
Material.
Yeah, I learned that you don't have to be in the religious to do something. But I have a huge amount of respect, and there's religious orders over there, and they've got the amount of good education and good medical facilities that have come from these orders. There would be so many people dead if they weren't there. And
it's been one of the contributions right throughout history.
Yes. So, and there's one particular religious order, the Christian Brothers, who've got a school on the other side of town, and they were so supportive to me when I was getting off the ground.
And given the fact that it's called St. Jude's as the actual school, I mean, is it considered a Christian school? I mean, are they taught anything from the Bible? Or?
Well, yes, okay. So we do not select kids based on tribe, which is another issue, or religion, but it is known as a Christian-based school, not an Islamic-based school. So we've got about 20% Muslim in our population in our area, and that's about the same as in the school. We promote staff based on effort, initiative, passion for the school. So each of our headmasters, remember I was telling you we had to breed our own? Each of our headmasters started out as a teacher in the school. So two of my headmasters are Christian and one of them is Muslim. And I've got a deputy who's a Muslim and they're all of different tribes. It's important for the kids to see that it doesn't matter what tribe you belong to or what, you know, religion you belong to. We can all work together for the benefit of the school as a whole.
So you're up to 1,300 students now and umpteen building projects to try and keep up with them, another 200 coming at the end of the year. Where's the dream? Where do you think it might, you know, go in the future?
Well, at this stage, like today, I'm just trying to work out how we're going to get money for year 9 bricks and then next year, year 10 bricks and then the year after,
as
year 11 and 12. And then so
Maybe that's the way you do it. Maybe that's the only way you could do
survival
it.
Survival tactics.
I would imagine that. I mean, like you said, you know, you haven't got any background in education, let alone building schools.
Just 1 year ahead.
Yeah.
But 2014 is the finish of our construction at this point. And then in 2014, I'd like to send our children to tertiary institutions around Africa. And after they finish tertiary, I thought we might give each child up to $5,000 or something, of which they can use to start up a little business in Tanzania. And then they gradually pay that money back to the school so we can recycle it again through future students, because we'll be churning out from 2014, there'll be about 220 graduates a year. It's a lot of kids to put through tertiary.
Yeah, definitely. And you're looking for volunteers? Volunteers can come over and do anything with you?
We used to a lot, but now the school has a huge amount of, so we're over 90% Tanzanian staff now. So we only have Western positions. In high-skilled areas that I can't fill locally. So we have a website. You just have to Google, use Mr. Google, St. Jude, Tanzania, and we have a job vacancies on that website.
Okay.
At the moment, we're needing a good building supervisor because I have very creative builders.
That's a very diplomatic way to put it.
Teacher librarian and a financial controller.
All right, schoolofstjude.co.tz. Is the other address. Otherwise, like you said, Google it. schoolofstjude.co.tz. Gemma, nice to have you here and all the best as you, you know, head over and build those next school blocks.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology. To hear more from Open House, visit openhouseonline.com.au.